T Health Show, your medical lifestyle podcast, brought to you by the T Clinic.
Good morning, I'm Dr. Mark. This is the T Health Show. And today in studio, I have my lovely friend and dermatologist, Dr. Pulile Mpofu. Pulile, it's always such a pleasure to have you here. Good morning.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to come here.
And our lovely producer, Simpiwe. Now, when I spoke to Pulile, we decided on the topic of pigmentation. Mm-hmm. Pulile, why did we decide on that topic?
Because it's so common and it causes such distress. So we thought it has to be addressed.
So if we look at what pigmentation actually is, to try and explain it to someone with no medical background, it's basically overproduction of a protein pigment that gives color to our skin, our eyes, our hair. And this production is overstimulated and blotchy.
Yes, it's the main component in pigmentation. We know that hemoglobin also plays a role, and carotene does give a yellowish tinge to the skin and contributes to that. But melanin, as you have mentioned, is the main pigment, is the main reason why skin gets pigmented. We'll see that in heavily pigmented people, we will find the granules all over the surface of the skin, from the epidermis to even the stratum corneum. But in less pigmented people, it might just concentrate on the basal layer and a few other cells above it.
Okay, so I like that you touched on the anatomy of the skin, because when we take a look at the treatment of pigmentation and the different options that we have available, this is going to play, understanding the anatomy and where the pigmentation is lying is going to play a very big part in choosing what we're going to use and what's going to be effective.
And to determine the prognosis. Because when the pigment is low lying, when it's below the surface of the skin, which we call dermal pigment, which is blotchy, blue-gray pigment, we have to communicate to the patient that it's going to be a very tough road.
Okay. So, Sims.
Yes.
I always ask the question when I train aesthetic doctors, what is the first thing that you see when you look at someone?
Should be their eyes, isn't it?
Pulile, what do we see when we look at someone? We see the skin first. Do you agree?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
Although we are told that we see the V-shape and decide someone is beautiful. But with the skin is the main thing you see.
Yeah. Okay. So if you look at some of your more famous older actresses, they're still gorgeous. They're wrinkled. They have lines. We can see that they're aging and sagging. But the skin is always flawless.
Yes.
Yeah, it's that glow that they always talk about. You know?
The young people call it the classy skin.
Ish.
So, you know, but when I started in the aesthetic field, I always said to patients, and I realized very quickly, all women want to be able to get up in the morning, put on some eyeliner or mascara and lip gloss and walk out the door.
Yes.
That's the ideal. And we can only do that when we have flawless, radiant, even pigmented skin.
Yes.
It's Halle Berry. Here she sits right in front of us. Pulile's got the most amazing skin.
Thank you.
Pulile, we have different types of pigmentation, or shall we start with the causes? No, let's start with the different types of pigmentation.
You mean pheomelanin or?
No, you know, the conditions. Okay. Melasma, post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation, sun damage.
Okay. The most important thing to mention is that the sun itself can pigment the skin, which is, and the cumulative exposure to the sun can affect the skin tone. So people should be aware that no matter how healthy they are, if there's no protection to the sun, they will lose their luminosity and their beautiful uniformity of the pigmentation. So protection from the sun is important. So overexposing yourself to the sun can darken the skin. But the common causes of pigmentation that we see in our rooms is melasma, which is or chloasma, which is the hormonally induced pigmentation of the skin on the forehead, the nose, the upper lip, and the cheeks. What is important is that
it looks like a butterfly, but
yes, it's called the mask of pregnancy.
Yeah,
because it has is the butterfly distribution the same area that lupus.
Yes.
Those are the areas that are more exposed to the sun.
So you know what we think about pregnancy pigmentation.
Yes,
I've seen it a lot. It's definitely hormone driven.
Yes, it's not only in pregnancy. It's just that it got the name mask of pregnancy because it's more common in pregnancy.
So but we have two different, chloasma, which is more pregnancy type, and then melasma, yes, when the patient exhibits this
type of features,
pigmentation
not,
without being pregnant.
Yes.
Now, let's stick to the pregnancy part. When does it happen in pregnancy? Is it after the pregnancy or during the pregnancy?
It can be during the pregnancy, but most people notice it after the pregnancy. But the I nearly said the scriptures. The publications mention that it's supposed to improve after pregnancy, but it, most of the time it doesn't. Some people notice it more. I think it's the awareness becomes more. When you are pregnant, you have other things that are not going right, so you are not fussy about how you look like. But after they've given birth, most of them then complain about it. But it's supposed to then improve, which we don't see often.
Okay, so is there a way of predicting whether you're going to get this during pregnancy? Say your mother had it.
Yes, there's a family history. There is a family history.
Okay,
yes.
So if mum developed pigmentation during pregnancy, your chances are also there.
Especially if you're not protecting from the sun.
Okay, so again, sun, big culprit.
Yes.
We also have other types of pigmentation.
Yes.
Post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation.
That's the other common one, which we see after skin conditions, especially after acne, or after anything, even insect bites, or any
burns.
Other anything that can cause inflammation, even after procedures like chemical pills, microneedling, less so, but anything that causes inflammation, especially if it causes redness, anything that makes your skin.
There's this vampire
facial. This is what Dr. Pauline referred to. It's microneedling.
Okay.
It's very good for the skin, but I mean, some people will react.
Okay. I had one patient.
I had one too.
And she was Italian. So a Mediterranean skin tone and beautiful skin. And we did a series of needlings and she developed post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation. It's the first time that I ever saw it and also the last, but it was scary enough because it's difficult to treat that initially. So we have your infective skin conditions or dermatitises like your eczemas and psoriasis and those things. Do they also cause post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation?
Yes, they do. We do get that. What I wanted to mention is that the type of skin determines whether inflammation is more likely, whether pigmentation is more likely. The darker you are, the more likely it is that after inflammation you will pigment. So we doctors have to be careful with procedures that when we deal with darker skinned patients, we are very careful when we do inflaming procedures because the chances of pigmentation are higher. Even for conditions like eczema, psoriasis, lichen planus, those that inflame the skin, we tend to get post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation. So it makes the doctor very careful when you deal. Even mild inflammation is treated aggressively in people who are dark because of the potential for pigmentation.
Okay, so I want us to quickly run through the different skin types. For us, it's natural and normal because we think about that on a daily basis. We have the Fitzpatrick scale to which we assign patients. So help me if I'm wrong. Fitzpatrick 1 is your real Irish-looking people. They have red hair, very fair skin, freckly, and they burn if they go
into
the
sun. Yes, they don't tan. They
burn and peel. Mm. And then Fitzpatrick 2 is your fair-skinned Caucasians, usually blonde, blue eyes, don't tan well.
Yes, but there's they're better than the type 1.
And then Fitzpatrick 3 is someone like me. Darker hair, darker eyes.
That's where we start seeing
problems.
The likelihood of pigmentation, yes.
So we tan well. We get that Pisbin brown, healthy looking. But you know what? Again, as we'll see later, with complications. And then we get, according to me, the most difficult skin type. Is your Fitzpatrick 4s, which is your Indian patients and your South Asian patients. And any kind of inflammation there is quite bad. And then we get Fitzpatrick 5, so that's you and Simpiwe, light, black. And then Fitzpatrick 6s, which are your Nubians, your West Africans, Ethiopians, those really ebony kind of black people. Do they also have this problem to the same degree, or is it more the 4s and the 5s?
It's just that it doesn't show that well, but they do. Because the darker you are, the more bigger your melanocytes are. And they have more dendrites. So they are more likely to deposit pigment into the stratum corneum. But if the darker you are, the more invisible pigmentation is, new pigmentation is, because you are already dark. So they tend to do well in the sense that it's not visible when they get dark, unlike someone who's type 4 to 5, because they are not dark enough to conceal new pigment.
Yeah.
So when they get post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation, it's visible.
Yeah. I often have my African patients come in, and they will pull up a sleeve and then say, "This is my color. This is what I want to be." And then I ask them, "But have you been wearing sunscreen?" And they say, "No, but we don't burn." And I said, "Well, that's why your face and your hands and your forearms and your neck is darker than the rest of your body." So we've looked at sun exposure, infections and skin conditions that cause post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation, hormonal changes. Now, hormonal changes does not only happen when you go from a prepubescent to puberty. Do we see this in children as well?
No, we don't.
For that initial hormone change?
I've never seen a baby cloasma. I've never seen a baby with cloasma.
Okay, but then we start seeing it in our reproductive years, not only in pregnancy.
No.
Now, some of the medication that we use can cause pigmentation, and specifically hormonal estrogen, contraceptives.
Especially estrogen. Estrogen-containing contraceptives. Remember, the progesterone-only ones are less likely to cause it. Because progesterone is also blamed, but it's estrogen that is the main driver.
Okay,
so the combination
estrogen containing
yes.
You know what, I often say, you know what, we need to find a contraceptive for men.
And hormone replacement, postmenopausal hormone replacement, because it's estrogen.
I have to be honest, you know, but that's something in my practice that I deal with on a daily basis, because that's what the T clinic does. And by hook or by crook, and you know, let's touch wood, I haven't seen any of my female patients complain about pigmentation. But the majority of them do look after their skins. And as an aesthetic practitioner, we insist that they wear sunscreen. So what are the other medications that can cause pigmentation problems?
Antibiotics like tetracyclines, especially doxycycline.
But that sensitizes you to the sun.
Yes, and it causes intense pigmentation, especially minocycline. It can darken the skin badly.
Okay, so if you have chloroquine, these are usually medication that we give specifically for acne patients.
We give for other conditions. We give for other, especially for acne. But we give it for other conditions like rosacea. We give it for folliculitis.
On a,
we give it for Pityriasis, like lichenoides.
So that's for a long time. It's not just your normal 5-day course of antibiotics.
Yes, it's prolonged treatment, at least 3 months. We don't want to go beyond 3 months because then there's the danger of resistance.
So, Bulile, I think most people think pigmentation irregularities face. Mm. But we also can pigment in other places.
Yes.
Stomach or especially thorax?
Especially estrogen related. You can get the flexures, the skin folds.
Okay.
They can darken.
Oh, yes, I've seen that. Mm. It's dark and thick.
Mm. But the most important, in my opinion, is the insulin-related pigmentation, which you call acanthosis nigricans. Because when you are dark in your neck, in your armpits, in your inner thighs, you could be having the metabolic syndrome. So we need to look out for that. Because when we check their insulin and it's high, then they are likely to be having to get diabetes types to get other
hypertension, yes, the elevated cholesterol levels.
Yes, yes. So we need to look out for that pigmentation and not just treat the pigmentation with a depigmenting agent without really checking whether they are whether they have the metabolic syndrome. So it's a good sign for us to check for their real well-being.
Yeah, I on this show we've spoken extensively about metabolic disease and metabolic syndrome because. Mm. It's the new pandemic. It's so incredibly prevalent. And the numbers are rising at an alarming rate.
Yes.
People are changing their lifestyles.
Yes. And it's visible on the skin.
Okay. So that for me is a new one. I read about it. I forgot about it. So guys, if you are starting to put on a little bit of weight and you're starting to see changes to the color of the skin.
In the neck, especially the armpits.
You need to go and see your healthcare provider. Mm. That's a nice one to remember because people, it's a silent disease. Yes. Now we have a symptom.
Yes.
But does this also apply when you're losing weight or is it just when you're gaining weight?
I think it's one of the symptoms of the metabolic syndrome is weight gain.
Okay.
Yes. Whether it's a consequence or a cause.
Okay.
So I think most people want to know, how do we manage this?
Mm.
Pigmentation is notoriously difficult
it's
to
very
treat.
Difficult.
We used to say you don't cure pigmentation, you maintain it. So the problem I think that we have is misinformation. Would you agree?
Yes. Yes, we deal with that a lot.
Over-the-counter potions and lotions, the stuff that you can buy in Clicks and Dis-Chem and at the pharmacy or your retail store, do they really work?
It depends. For pigmentation, we have to combine, we have to understand the physiology of pigmentation and combine things that would really help. So like antioxidants, like topical vitamin C is available over the counter. The topical vitamin C, that is part of the treatment. But most of the things provided, some have cortisone, some have mercury, so some have steroids. So some of the things that are touted as pigmentation creams, even on the internet, TikTok and places like that, are just harmful to the skin. So it's not safe to just buy something. There are many selling points like dermatologically tested or organic.
I'm specifically thinking of the Nivea, the Nivea ads that I see every evening on TV. I think it's Nivea and then there's a Revlon one. And so
the Dove ones, you know, they just... The science behind it and...
So pigmentation is really complex. We have four pathways that form pigmentation, tyrosinase. And you will know them better than I do, so I'm handing over to you.
I don't understand the four pathways. Which one? I don't
know tyrosinase. To make pigmentation, when we treat pigmentation, we usually block a couple of different pathways. I know tyrosinase is one.
It's the most we block that. We block tyrosinase. We inhibit tyrosinase with hydroquinone, with kojic acid and things like that. Or we can inhibit the transfer of melanosome. Is that what you're asking?
Yes.
We can interfere with transfer of melanosomes, then we, like the bionic amide in Cespera or abutin. We can do that. Or we can remove the pigment by exfoliation.
Whether it's mechanical or chemical or
mechanical
laser.
Or chemical, yes.
So I don't know whether that's what.
Or you want the physiology of pigmentation formation?
Yes.
I've forgotten that one.
You know what? We know these things.
It includes dopamine and whatever. No, I've forgotten it. It was for exams.
I'm glad I'm not the only one.
Pass and go.
We sift through the knowledge.
No, the gist is that there's activation of tyrosine by tyrosinase. So you inhibit the enzyme.
Yeah.
So you need to look for products that inhibit the enzyme. You know, hydroquinone does it in different ways. It affects the melanocyte itself.
Yes.
It inhibits the enzyme, it inhibits the melanin, so it works in different ways, but because it damages the melanocyte, it's not our main. We start with it, but we don't continue with it.
So, you know what? I like that you mentioned hydroquinone because I really want to talk about that.
Yes.
Hydroquinone is a product that was widely used, but it's subsequently been banned in a lot of countries.
Because even here,
of the misuse or overuse of it, it's teratogenic.
Yeah, not enough is absorbed. We know that happens in rats and all that, but in humans, really, you don't use enough to do that. But it's banned for personal use, but for prescription, it's still available.
Yes, to us.
Yes.
I have seen horrific side effects
in patients who have used
hydroquinone.
We see them all the time.
One of the biggest complications is you use hydroquinone to lighten the skin
and then
you
darken
and
it.
You have exactly the opposite effect.
The opposite,
effect.
Yes.
It's literally like you've fallen
into
tar.
And it's permanent. And it doesn't go away on treatment. You have to do laser, you have to do micropigmentation, and you still don't really micro needling, and you still just barely improve it. It should be avoided.
So, you know what? There's a lot of products that contain hydroquinone.
Many.
But, you know, our patients overuse them, and then they also get hold of stuff and they mix their own hydroquinone.
Yes.
And the problem is that they, you know what? When we use hydroquinone as medical practitioners, we do a targeted treatment.
Yes.
We only use it on the areas of pigmentation.
And also we are aware of the percentage and we are aware of the duration because we know where and we check the skin properly. Even if it's targeted, you have to check for the initial stages of the complication and back off immediately. So if a patient is not aware of how it looks like when it's starting to change, they'll continue to use it, thinking the pigmentation is just getting worse. So it's important to know the percentage, to control and reduce the percentage. So if it's just self-medication, the percentage is not controlled, the duration is not controlled, the signs of damage are not observed.
Yeah. And, you know what, I think a lot of people use it and may still go into the sun, and that just makes things worse.
It makes things worse. Every product that we use for the pigmentation will not work if the person is not protecting from the sun. But hydroquinone is worse because it propagates the complication to be exposed to the sun.
Okay. So other potions and lotions. So we've spoken about vitamin C. We've spoken about hydroquinone, which you really have to avoid unless prescribed by...
And you should give a history.
A medical practitioner that really, really deals with pigmentation problems.
When you change doctors, you should give them a history of the fact that you have used it already. Because sometimes the doctor starts afresh not knowing that you have had already 5 months of it. and your pigmentation is just stubborn and needs something else, not hydroquinone. But when you doctor hop, everyone is starting afresh. And everyone is giving you what they think they are giving for only a few months. And you are getting this treatment continuously because we keep on changing. So no one is aware of the duration that we should be aware of.
Other than sunscreen, what are the topical, routinely daily stuff that we can do at home to prevent pigmentation irregularities?
You need to prevent inflammation. Because we know, my prof used to say, if it's red, it will be black. So avoid inflaming your skin. Avoid things that irritate your skin and it's not controlled, because that irritation will then pigment. You know? Using maybe glycolic acid, there are products that have glycolic acid. If it's epidermal pigmentation, it will improve because it's on the stratum corneum. So the minor exfoliation.
Of skin that will exfoliate.
But products that contain abutin, kojic acid, tranexamic acid is a big one. We even take it orally for melasma. It helps a lot, not only for melasma, but for any vascular pigmentation, you know, pigmentation that has a red background, the tranexamic acid will be useful. People are always surprised why we give tranexamic acid, but it really is a big player in melasma.
Yeah, I remember when I was still doing deep laser treatments where we would basically give a patient a second, third degree burn almost. I always started treating them with at least 2 months before the treatment. And then continued for months afterwards.
A tyrosinase inhibitor also, when you're going to do a procedure, you have to disable the pigmentation formation. It reduces the incidence of post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation. If you're anticipating that there might be post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation after the procedure, you don't do the procedure immediately. You treat it with an inhibition of the... You can use hydroquinone, can use kojic acid, can use Cispera, any of those systemin, any of those products that are treating pigmentation, but there's no pigmentation yet. You are just preventing that. When you irritate the skin, you don't get pigmentation. So that's an important point also, to pre-treat before an inflaming procedure is seen. Things like we mentioned retinoids.
Yes, I was just going to ask you, one of the gold products, if I can call it like that, in preventing signs of aging when it comes to topical treatments is retinol.
They can pigment also if they're not, if the person reacts or they don't know how to initiate the treatment. So they have to be well advised how to introduce them
and
into their system.
You know, the same as with any other active ingredient, I want to say, retinol you only use during the night. You never go with retinol on. You've just put retinol in and you go out into the sun. It does create sensitivity, with leading to the inflammation and redness, and ultimately to pigmentation.
They should start with alternate day or once a week, then twice a week, slowly introduce it, like we do with systemin. We start slow. So most of the irritating products, even hydroquinone, can irritate some people. So starting very slowly with treatment, at least in it creates tolerance on the skin.
Okay. So I want to quickly circle back while we with topical treatments. Acne. We know that in darker skins, acne has a nasty tendency of causing post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation. In Caucasian skins, it's more redness than dark marks. But your type 4, type 5 skin types, definitely hyperpigment. How do I prevent the hyperpigmentation, or how can I prevent the hyperpigmentation for a patient who has acne, other than treating the acne itself?
Yes, treating it promptly and considering it severe even when it's mild because of the potential for pigmentation. But we know that adding a retinoid like adapalene
yeah,
is proven to help with pigmentation. And skinorin, azelaic acid. You can treat the acne with azelaic acid, knowing that it also helps with the pigmentation. Not as strong as adapalene. Adapalene is, there are studies to show that treating your acne with adapalene also reduces the
pigmentation. Adapalene is part of a different gel.
Yes, it's in Epiduo also.
Also.
Yes, but Epiduo has benzyl peroxide as well.
Okay, would that be a treatment that our patients could maybe ask for when they go to their GP?
Yes.
Epiduo 4, it's a little bit stronger. It's the new one that's been out in the market.
Yes, it's 0.3. Yeah.
Okay.
The other one is 0.1.
I think that, you know what, our people that might listen to the show sitting in rural areas that do not have access to dermatologists, et cetera, who need to understand there are medications.
Yes.
And I'm going to name them because this is a podcast, which means that it's not advertising. Someone needs to go and look for it.
Yes.
So products that you would recommend, we could maybe ask our GPs to think about is different gel.
Because it has adapalene.
And Epiduo?
Yes.
And then you mentioned Skinorin.
Yes,
Skinorin. I forgot about Skinorin. I have to be honest, I never prescribed it.
Glenmark has an adapalene as well. I forgot the name. What is it called? But Glenmark has an adapalene also.
Okay. Mm. Now, prevention always better than cure. When it comes to acne people, sunscreen is so important.
For everybody.
The problem with sunscreen is if you don't use a proper sunscreen, you can actually make the acne a little bit worse.
Yes. It mustn't be occlusive. Because some of the sunscreens are meant for the body so that when you sweat, they can still be retained.
Yeah.
So they are too greasy for the face. In fact, many people find that they don't find sunscreens user-friendly because of the irritation of the eyes. So choosing the correct sunscreen to prevent irritation on the eyes. Those that have irritation can use sunscreen specifically. There are a few that don't irritate the eyes. So look out for those. Greasiness, most sunscreens are greasy. So if they are greasy, they'll aggravate acne because they clog the pores. If they have the residue, the grayish residue, some look purple, some even cause contact dermatitis. So work with your doctor to choose a proper product. Don't just stop using it and say sunscreens don't treat you well.
So,
but avoid over greasing the face.
Quick one.
Yes.
There's moisturizers that also have like sunscreen in it.
Yes.
Do those work?
If the SPF is high enough, because 30 is good enough, but
okay.
I mean, you get more from, slightly more from more, you know? SPF 30 is good enough. So some sunscreens, some moisturizers have SPF 30. That's good enough.
Oh, okay.
It's one product that would, but it must be written that non-comedogenic. Then it tells you that it has been tested for not clogging the pores.
Okay.
Let the company commit themselves. If they don't say non-comedogenic, assume that it's comedogenic. Comedogenic means has an ability to cause acne.
Sure.
So if they say non-comedogenic, it means they have tested it and they found that it does not cause acne. Look for that in a product.
Yeah, I think if I can think about what's available in most retail stores, the only one that I would choose specifically for the face when I have skin problems would be something like the Cetaphil one. I don't know whether Zeroderm is available in retail stores.
Yes, it's available. The SPF, they have a 34. It's available. And It's spreadable and it's user-friendly. But there are lots of them. I mean, Eucerin has a gel cream.
Oh, yes.
La Roche-Posay has a fluid. Isdin has a very nice, nicely textured sunscreen. Many of the Uriage has a good one. Many of the companies have good sunscreens that are not clogging the pores.
Okay, so there's no excuse not to use one.
No.
Okay.
No.
So let's move on with treatment a little bit. now I have, let's say, I have post-pregnancy pigmentation
mm-hmm.
or hormonal pigmentation.
Mm-hmm.
What are our possible treatment modalities? What do we do at home? And if the stuff that we use at home doesn't work, I go to an esthetician or aesthetic practitioner or my dermatologist, whatever possible scenarios, Pauline.
Yes. They are going to make sure that you are using an appropriate sunscreen and that you are using it properly. Because the usage is also very important. Because
you
most
have to use it before you go out into the sun, not when you're in the sun.
Yeah, before, but reapply. Reapply when swimming or more exposed. But use it also when you are indoors. Because ultraviolet A can penetrate windows, can penetrate clouds. So you can't say you are not in the sun when it's cloudy. Because ultraviolet A is there all the time. It's there when it's cloudy. It's there when it's when there's smoke. It's there when you are indoors. It's over. We can't overemphasize that sunscreen should be used all the time, not only when you are going out. But going out should also, we should also remember that most sunscreens work after 30 minutes of application. So apply it whilst you are still in the house. Most of them specify that they only at their maximum effect, efficacy when you have applied them 30 minutes before. So apply earlier, but reapply during every 2 hours when you are exposed to too much sun or when you are swimming or sweating.
Okay.
Enough. They say 2 grams per centimeter square. That is about 5 mils for the face. That is what is sufficient. When they say they've tested,
it's a teaspoon.
Yes. When they say they've tested a sunscreen and it's SPF something, they mean it is that SPF when you have used a teaspoon on the face.
Yeah. I've been using it.
No
wrong.
Wonder mine lasts so long. I don't. Yeah, here I am and saying, you know what? I put sunscreen on every single day.
And 30 mils for the body. They usually say 2 lines on the last digits. That's about 5 mils. And 30 mils for the body. Like if you're going to the beach and you're applying it on your whole body, it's about 30 mils. So most of us don't apply enough sunscreen to get that SPF on the label. We are not getting that SPF on the label because we are not applying sufficiently.
I learned something new today, Dr.
I'm looking at my fabulous tan and then I think, but this is just sun damage because, you know what, a bottle, which is what, 300 mils, lasts
forever.
Me a whole season.
What?
Okay, and it's supposed to last me 10 days.
Yes, yes.
Okay, Pauline,
That is the argument that is given when we are saying people should use a high SPF. Remember that SPF 15 is supposed to be enough. In the lab, when they test SPFs, 15 is enough. But in real life, we are not using enough. We are not reapplying. So 15 will not be enough in real life.
So if you don't want to really layer and layer and layer it on, just use a higher SPF.
It still needs to be 5 mils.
And frequently.
Because that SPF 50 that is written on the label is only achieved when you are using enough.
Okay. Okay, so sunscreen.
Proper usage of sunscreen. You can ask your doctor to prescribe tranexamic acid. It helps a lot in melasma. If you don't have a contraindication, if there's no history of clotting, no DVT and things like that. If you are not on contraceptives, we don't want you to be on anything that is a pro-clot drug.
Nervous.
Yes.
Okay.
But so if you are not on any hormonal treatment, adding tranexamic acid to your treatment is important. Then glycolic acid can be used.
So this is topical glycolic acid, home care.
The home care.
I know that new strata, for
it
instance,
helps the penetration of the other products.
Okay.
Retinoids and glycolic acid are good to add to the treatment because they help the penetration of the actives. If you are using glycolic acid and hydroquinone, you are getting more hydroquinone in. If you're using retinoids and hydroquinone, like you're getting the hydroquinone in, you're getting the kojic acid in, you're getting the arbutin in if you add a glycolic acid or an alpha hydroxy acid. Okay. Or a retinoid.
Okay.
So that's important.
I know there's glycolic preparations that you can use at home. That's nice and safe. I don't know which ones you're familiar with. I know the one that we get from New Strata.
Yes, New Strata is a very good product. But some products have glycolic acid in them. Cispera has glycolic acid.
Yes.
Dermalin. Biluma had, I think, but it's not available anymore. I think Dermalin has glycolic acid.
Yes, it does.
Yes. Okay. So using things that have glycolic acid will also help in penetrating. The Neotin has glycolic acid as well.
Okay. So topical preparations, speak to someone that actually know. Mm-hmm. And this is not your locum beauty counter assistant.
It's not safe because then they are not aware of the contents of products. They only depend on what is written. And products, companies that are not really big on research, they usually say that the labels should not be trusted. That's why we tend to really rely on the companies where we know that research is taken seriously. Then we trust that when they say vitamin C, they mean it. We know many products that are sold online and in other places. They say vitamin C, arbutin, alpha hydroxy acid. They know what patients are looking for. They're looking for retinoids. They're looking for niacinamide. But they have cortisone. They don't have what is written.
Yeah, and cortisone is it not lightens good quickly. For the skin.
It lightens the skin quickly. Patients are happy when they start using it, but then they get more pigmentation after that. They get rosacea, they get acne, they age quickly.
Yeah.
Because of the thinning of the skin.
Yeah,
they get infections.
I remember, you know, with the podcast that you and I did on inflammatory skin conditions, the rashes that itch and the itches that rash. So, which you treat with cortisone, and you then said, you know, you only need use the cortisone for a very short period of time.
Yes.
So
we rely on it. I usually say it's like the helicopter. It helps when you have a real injury, but you can't be using it every day to the mall.
Okay.
So it's not, we're not being a cosmetic phobic here. We're not being steroid phobic, but we are using it correctly.
Okay. So the topical stuff's not really giving me enough. What do I do now? I go to my aesthetic doctor or my dermatologist. Mm-hmm. And what are you guys going to do? I'm immediately
thinking
of
pills. Yes. We are going to combine the things that we need. Like most people will use three products that are doing the same thing. We're going to check whether what you are using is addressing the different aspects of pigmentation.
Okay.
Then chemical peels are also part of the solution.
So the chemical peels that we
superficial.
Use.
Yeah. Superficial chemical peels.
So we're thinking about glycolic acid. Yes. We're thinking a little bit about lactic
salicylic.
Acid. Salicylic and maybe azelaic.
Mandelic.
And mandelic.
Mandelic, yes.
Okay. So these different peel combinations, I think the majority of it that we have in South Africa, if they come from reputable companies and if you had a reputable medical practitioner, you should be safe. Mm-hmm. The problem is if you peel too deep and you create excessive inflammation.
Yes. For type 4 to 6 skin, dermal pigmentation, dermal peeling, full thickness peeling is likely to pigment the skin. It's likely to pigment the skin better.
Yeah, this is your TACs.
Yes, the one that do deep peeling.
Okay.
You need superficial.
A modified Jesner's peel doesn't go that deep.
We can use it more safely. I like preparing the skin first with either
Hydranic or something like that.
Yes, or hydroquinone just for a month or so. Then do the peel.
Okay.
Because some patients, even though it's a safe peel, they still pigment.
Okay. Your other your devices like microneedling,
microdermabrasion.
Microdermabrasion, we have. I'm always afraid of microdermabrasion. You know what? If someone is coming with a diamond tip to my skin, you know what? I have to really trust their hands.
Yes.
Is it a safe procedure to do?
In safe hands. In safe hands it is, where the patient is well analyzed whether the skin is suitable, and also pre-treatment.
And microplaning?
That doesn't remove much pigment because it just removes the stratum corneum, but it does make the skin glow at that time.
Okay.
It's not...
It can be dangerous if it's overdone.
It's
again,
usually,
causing,
they usually cut.
Inflammation.
They usually even cut the skin. We've seen patients with cuts with the blade.
Okay. Mm. We move on to a slightly more invasive treatments when we start looking
lasers.
At dermal planing, which is a little bit deeper, and then your laser treatments,
yes.
IPL, BBL.
Yes, but the chances of pigmentation for type 4 to 6 are so high that I don't consider them at all for type 4 to 6.
Okay, so these are really pigment, maybe age spots and stuff like that for patients type 1 and
type
2.
Type 1, yes, yes. But there are two lasers which can be used for darker skin, NDYAG, and because they have a long pulse, and the picosecond laser. Those are safe for dark skin.
Okay. And this is only really at specialist medical practitioners.
Yes.
I know what those lasers cost. They're over a million rand.
Yes. Wait, what?
Yeah, yeah. So if you go to your corner beauty store and they say they're going to do a laser treatment for you, ask them how much they paid for
it. It's hopefully nothing. Hopefully. I always say it's hopefully nothing. When they say it's a laser, maybe it's just LED.
Yeah. So light LED, photodynamic therapy for pigmentation, your ALAs and stuff like that, can that work for pigmentation or
we
is
use
it
more
for acne. The damaged skin?
We use it for damaged skin. We use it for acne. We use it for skin cancer.
Will it improve the pigmentation if you are willing to do a treatment like that, which, by the way, is incredibly painful?
I don't think it's not part of my solution.
Okay.
It's not part of my solution. I don't think you'd have to the pain is, it just makes, it's out of range
for the
treatment
benefit.
Of pigmentation.
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. But for skin cancer, patients with basal cell carcinoma,
we do that all the time.
Actinic keratosis.
Yes.
It's
a treatment of choice.
Good treatment.
It's a treatment of choice for that.
No scarring.
It helps very well. It helps very well. There's no scarring. It's effective, and it can be repeated after a few months. So it's a very reliable mode of treatment.
Okay, pigmentation is all around us. I think people who battle with pigmentation irregularities really know how. Big the effect on your self-esteem can be. It's difficult to hide pigmentation.
It is, but camouflage is part of what we suggest to patients when they have like cosmetic ochronosis, something that can be changed easily.
What's that? What does that mean?
Using effective, we help them choose an effective makeup foundation, concealer.
Yeah.
There are those that are able to conceal the pigmentation and help a patient not to have social isolation.
So we've spoken a lot about dark pigmentation, hyperpigmentation. I actually find that hypopigmentation, depigmentation, is almost more difficult. Well, it's definitely more difficult to treat.
Exactly.
And on darker skin types, it's far more difficult to hide.
Yes, and it's very frustrating. It causes so much concern in social isolation, especially for vitiligo. I mean, we find that we encourage patients to treat quickly.
When they see this first little spot.
Yes, because the more generalized it is, the more widespread it is, the less likely it is to respond.
Vitiligo, it's an autoimmune condition?
It's an autoimmune condition, yes.
Is it associated with any other medical stuff that this is a symptom of maybe something underlying that I'm missing?
Thyroid antibodies. It can be associated with that.
So Hashimoto's and those kind of stuff, vitiligo is more prevalent.
It can be associated with pernicious anemia.
Okay, so pernicious anemia is one of the B vitamins, am I not right?
It's one of the anemias.
Yeah, okay. And then treatment for something like vitiligo?
Topical steroids, calcineurin inhibitor like Protopic and Elidel, those are very helpful, especially for facial vitiligo, especially in combination with eczema-lite. We get very good results, especially for periorbital, around the eyes, around the mouth. Facial lesions, they respond very, very well to that combination. But phototherapy, full body phototherapy, it also helps.
Yes, I remember when Dr. Palili is going to kill me for this. Mm-hmm. I remember we had one of those photodynamic chambers at the University of Pretoria when I was a student. Mm-hmm. And instead of treating our patients for vitiligo, we used it as a tan can.
Dr. Mark.
So it's not a normal tan can. This is a tan can on steroids made by He-Man for... you know what? And today I am paying the price because I have a couple of sunspots. Mm-hmm. So
sunbeds are not the safest.
We
also give immunosuppressants. We can give cyclosporin. We get good results with.
Okay.
Yes, we can give cyclosporin and dexamethasone or prednisolone. That combination, it works. Pulses of steroids and cyclosporin. That's expensive though.
Very.
But it can help when it's still when it's still active, when it's still developing.
Yeah.
You can. But if it's too late and
it's already formed,
then it's difficult to. Yes, so you have to catch it whilst it's still active and give immunosuppressants.
I think one of the things that people forget is that treatment for skin conditions, especially freezing of stuff, if you think about freezing little keratoses and stuff like that,
can cause
hyperpigmentation, which is more unsightly.
Even steroid injections, when we inject keloids, sometimes there's a white spot that remains. But we know we inject it with saline and use phototherapy to encourage the repigmentation.
Okay. So if I have these white spots, Simpiwe, I remember Dr. Palili will confirm this. Back in the day, and I'm going many years ago.
Before my time?
Before your time, before your time. Some of the ladies who wanted to treat their wrinkles did deep phenol peels. Do you remember that?
Yes, they still do.
And, you know, but phenol, because it was a chemical peel that we used to do in theatre under anaesthetic.
Yes.
Because it's literally acid that eats away your skin. Had these raccoon eyes and raccoon mouths, literally where you have complete depigmentation around the mouth area. Mm. So it was a wrinkle-free mouth and chin. But, you know, it literally looked as if I kissed a panda.
Mm.
So those are things that we need to look out for.
Yes.
Palili, we're coming to the end of the show. Pigmentation, it's a difficult thing to treat. It's far easier to prevent.
Yes.
And prevention... Sunscreen, avoid the sun.
Early detection and proper treatment of skin conditions to avoid post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation.
So don't, if you have a rash, if you have an itch, don't leave it.
Yes.
Because the problems that's going to arise when this is gone is going to be with you for a long time.
Not supplementing prescribed treatment with home things. Because you might have something that contains retinoid and you use another retinoid at home, then you react. Don't supplement with your own things when you're on treatment.
Okay. If patients want to get hold of you, you are here in Rochester Place, yes, in Johannesburg. Yes. What is the contact number for your rooms if patients want to come and see you about pigmentation?
It's 011-336-0549.
Perfect. It will also be available on the Tea Clinic page and website. Dr. Mpofu, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. I see you as a wealth and an encyclopedia of information when it comes to skin. We will follow up again. We have a couple of other skin conditions which we haven't addressed yet, and some of the ones that I think we should revisit over the next couple of months. Next week, I will be back on the podcast party, Simpi. Are we moving over to podcast party completely, or are we already on podcast party?
It's already on podcast party.
Okay, so podcast party, you will find us on any podcast platform. And I have no idea what I'm talking about next week, as usual. So look out for us on social media. And Dr. Mpofu, again, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Until next week, we wish you all the best in health.
Thank you very much.
That was the Tea Health Show, empowering you with knowledge. Download all previous episodes on your favorite podcast platform. The Tea Health Show is brought to you by Tea Clinic.